Good morning. Hope everyone's awake. Try to play you some music. Get you moving a little bit. So, boy, that's loud over there. My name is Jeff Stokes. I'm a premier field engineer with Microsoft. So, basically that means for the last 3 years or so, I've been flying around the country, the United States mainly, doing service, teaching, best practices, helping people figure out what they've done wrong, where, and then how to remediate it. So a little bit about me. I've been in IT for a really long time. I remember when plug and play was going to put desktop engineers out of business. Well, that didn't really work out, did it? 10 years later, plug and play works pretty well. I've been at Microsoft for 4.5. I started as an escalation engineer in Exchange, where I handled crit sits for basically the end of the world on Sunday mornings, and then field engineering for 3 years. I also blog, if you're interested. A lot of my blogs have to do with performance of client or deployment of client. I used to be a big back-end guy where I would do server infrastructure and things like that, and we found that most of the difficult performance issues tend to be in the client space, actually. So I sort of gravitated towards there in the last few years. Previously, I've been a storage administrator, a consultant, an engineer, a network manager. I worked at a NOC in, for Earthlink in Atlanta. So I'm kind of well-rounded. I've done a lot of work with Cisco gear, you know, things like that, and then back-end server storage and whatnot. I have 2 kids, 2 dogs, really lazy ones. And then my daughter has this. I have no idea what it is. My wife bought it for her birthday. So I'm also a fan of old school rap. So, but I want to talk to you about infrastructure. And mainly, when we in field engineering look at infrastructure, we're looking at problems that occur during the design phase that get unvetted or don't get vetted out during test and user acceptance testing and then get rolled into production. And I would make a case for you that the most difficult thing to do is after you've got something in production is to go back and re-engineer it because it's not scaled properly. It's extremely difficult once you have a few thousand users using a mail system to kick them all off, redo the storage so it's acceptable without spending a lot of money and building a whole new system. So a lot of what I like to do is talk about how do we prevent those sort of issues that can occur in production environments. So we're going to talk about the proactive considerations. What do we do when we're designing a system to make sure that we're designing something that's actually going to be sustainable through the life cycle of that application or that methodology that we're doing in our business? An example would be SANs. SANs have a life cycle. When you implement a SAN, do you have a plan for how you're going to get your data off the SAN in 5 years? Or is that something that the guy that's going to be there in 5 years has to figure out? Typically, it's the guy, and then what? Instead of it being 5 years, it strings on to 7 or 8, and you pay for an extended support contract and things like that. So I'm going to talk about performance. Instead of performance as a reactive, oh no, the user's complaining, we're going to talk about performance as something that we go in and we vet out prior to implementation. There's a lot of tools to help you with this. Some of them are even free, and we'll talk about those. We're also going to talk about support and design considerations with infrastructure that you can put into place before you put something into production. Many times when a field engineer gets called on site in what we call a crit sit, you know, say you're an enterprise with 50,000 users and emails down for a day or two. So we come on site. Well, we need to collect a memory dump. Well, we're not configured for that. That's a problem. If we can't collect a memory dump, we can't get root cause, we can't figure out what's fixing your Exchange server, you're going to keep crashing over and over again. I've had crit sits where I've been dispatched on site where they have a boot volume for their C drive of 30 gig. And they have 128 gig of RAM, and CTS engineers want a full memory dump. Well, 128 gig dump doesn't fit in a 30 gig volume. So the answer that the guys get from my customer is, we need you to re-architect your storage for your 280 servers in case one of them blue screens so we can collect a memory dump, which isn't really the answer you want to get when your production web farm's crashing. So One of the things I want to kind of dispel is that performance is hard. A lot of people have this kind of view that performance is a kind of a difficult beast to tame in the environment, requires specialists perhaps. That's not really the case. We've written some tools, PFE field engineers have written some tools and written some guides on how to use these tools. They'll actually help you get ahead of the curve on your performance issues. So when you're using things like JetStress to validate your exchange storage, you're using SQLIO, disk iometer, to pound disk, you know, going through analyzing your network performance, the scalability of your VDI environment, you can go in and actually use some of these built-in tools, automated tools that we have for free to validate things and make sure it's going to be able to sustain your user load. And more importantly, it's not just the user load you need to sustain, but what do we do if it's if it looks good on paper, but the user experience is bad? It's still a failure. So how do we build in feedback loops so that we can get capture that user experience and really understand what the user pain is going to be? Because ultimately, we're getting to the point now in enterprises where users are driving the environment for us. Bring your own device. Bring your own device, in my opinion, not Microsoft's, Jeff's opinion, is that bring your own device is partly a failure of us to provide a good infrastructure for our end users. So instead of going through and re-engineering and re-architecting, it's like, okay, you win. Bring in your 10-year-old laptop, and we'll let you use it on our network, right? So there are some tools we can use. I did a presentation yesterday on the middle one here, WAS, the Windows Assessment Service. That's one of the more important ones. PAL you can use to validate storage and things like that. WAS we can actually use to validate our VDI infrastructure. We can also use it to take our build and put it on hardware we're considering purchasing and validate that that's actually going to work. What's the cost of us saving money and buying a cheaper hard drive for our laptops? Sure, we're going to save $50, but in the long run, people have done math and said, you know, if you take another 30 seconds for your enterprise to boot up over the span of the enterprise, you know, for that 3 years of the hardware life cycle, it adds up to a lot of money if you believe in that kind of accounting, which I'm on the fence on. So there we go. So field engineering is actually starting to write what we are sort of calling a book on performance, where it's essentially, if you remember back in the day, a choose your own venture guide. I have this. Okay, you have that. Well, do you want to go to this page because you think it might be this, or is you're using a SAN, so you should go to this page? So we're basically going to build for you a guide that then best practice analyzers can point to for up-to-date information on storage, networking, memory, CPU, things like that. So over time, this will be a living document that's contributed to by experts in the field, each in their own area, and essentially be there for free for you, the customer. PAL is a tool that we wrote to analyze performance BLG files from our servers. So a lot of the mystery that we have when we look at performance is we don't know what to gather. It's a black box. So we don't know what we need to know about the performance of this box. And if we gather too much data, it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. We affect the performance of the box by collecting too much data. So with PAL, break out here real quick. PAL will actually give us templates for each one of our server environments, our builds, that we can then use and capture just the performance metrics necessary to find out if our server is running correctly or not. So if you pick one of these, and we just added one for VMware, by the way. So if you're running in VMware, you can capture information on memory ballooning, which is pretty nice. But if you click on one of these, if you think the Active Directory template doesn't collect something that's important to you, you can actually give that feedback back to the field engineers that own that content. They'll put it under review and add that if it's necessary. So this, again, is another living type of document that over time gets evaluated, repurposed, You can see in here there's different versions for some of the applications like Exchange. So what we're trying to do is take some of that mystery out of the performance that's happening in your environment so that when you do your user acceptance testing, you're not just trusting that the user says, yeah, it ran okay. Is it enough that the business signed off on it? What happens when you do an acquisition and your user base doubles? Do you know if you can go beyond what you're currently sized for or not? I've been to some environments where they sort of price things improperly. Is anyone familiar with the Exchange storage calculator? Right, where you can go in and validate how much storage you need based on how many users, and this is how busy they're going to be. You need this kind of sand. So I had a customer that did the math incorrectly. They did it by a factor of 5 too much. The best disk performance I've ever seen in an Exchange environment, ever. But it came at a cost of millions of dollars they didn't have to spend. Now, they can handle growth going forward. That's great. But they'll never grow to the capacity that thing can handle, which is really a shame. We've also had people that buy too much RAM for their boxes because when you get feedback from your business that the application's slow, what's the easiest thing to do? We'll throw some extra RAM in the box. Well, that's more RAM to the VM. We'll give it another core and see what happens. Chances are the performance problems that you're seeing in your environment have nothing to do with the physical specs of the box. We're getting to the point now where people are trying to design their hardware on how to save power because they don't even need to be on. We're trying to core park. We're trying to sleep cores. So if we're doing that, do we really need the resources we're throwing at our environment? So this will help you validate that and price it properly, but then also be able to know how far you can scale. So an example of one of the template outputs, PAL will actually run through a BLG file that you've submitted to it. So you collect it with the template that it provides you, collect the data for a few hours, you run it through the engine, and it spits out an HTML report that's perfect for management. So they can actually see what's going on with links back to TechNet to the PFE perf guide that'll tell you exactly why it's unacceptable to have a disk queue length of 4,000. Why it's unacceptable that it took 25 seconds to do a 4K disk write. Or 6 minutes. I think that's my record. So here's a machine that it was a SQL box. SQL was locking pages in memory. So when SQL goes down to 2 meg free of available memory, it's in a little bit of a bad shape. That's the memory ballooning from VMware, taking 20 gig away from the SQL box because somebody else needed it. It's a simple example, but these things that we run into day in, day out in field engineering, we're basically trying to take those lessons learned and repeat, you know, give them back to you guys so you can engineer systems that, I mean, it's not that we don't like you. You know, we like coming out and visiting. But we'd rather do a chalk talk and help you build something cool than come in and fix a problem. Fair enough. The little dip, by the way, is where they turned off the ballooning driver. Another tool that we get into is XPerf. We have a lot of times where we'll run into customer environments where they will go in and build something in just, you know, 128 cores, a terabyte of RAM, huge SAN in the back end. Well, it still runs slow. Code and drivers will kill anything. It doesn't matter how big it is. DPCs, deferred procedure calls, bad drivers, poorly written code, spin locks, all this stuff. We're starting to see this more and more where the performance problems we end up having to troubleshoot in the field become CPU bound. Not in terms of the capacity of the CPU, but in terms of poorly written drivers and poorly written code that make waits. So when we're waiting on one particular core, no one else can do something in some cases. This one in particular I talked about yesterday is it's a 10 gigabit Ethernet card that got to about 2.83 gig and then couldn't go any higher. So when you're doing iSCSI on your server and you expect 10 gigabit Ethernet and you get about 2.8 or 3 gig and then nothing else happens and people start complaining because there isn't enough throughput, it's things like this. You can see right here, the count's low, which is great, but our waits we're waiting 200 milliseconds. That's the max. The average, 112 milliseconds. We're going to feel that in our infrastructure, where our acceptable wait times for disk I/O are in 10, 15 millisecond range. We're going to feel that in our drivers. One of the other things we have is a virtual round-trip analyzer. A lot of people are writing web-based applications now, so anyone can bring in a device and use it in their environment. That's great. Run into a lot of problems where the, let's use SharePoint as an example. I click on a page in SharePoint. It takes 3.5 minutes to paint back the results. That's a pain. That's a pain that your users aren't going to live with for long, particularly when it's the executive assistant that has the problem. Someone's going to hear about it. With this type of tool, you can actually go in, and then with the SharePoint dashboard, you can turn on some debugging. You can see the function calls all the way through SharePoint and back and tell exactly where that was bound. And then this is not a sales pitch at all, but I'm an instructor for this class, so I just thought I'd mention it. Premier actually has a performance class where we'll teach you to do troubleshooting and validation of your environment and really understand sort of the holistic health of a system, sort of a mini sysinternals, if you will. Then we have an advanced one where we'll teach you ETW tracing. We can teach you debugging. So now that I've beat you up with performance, I'm sure you weren't really expecting that. Let's talk about support. Monitoring, I could turn into a sales pitch on System Center and things like that, or third-party stuff. Well, that would make any sense, but you know what I mean. But there are also things out there that actually give you richer information that are free. If you're running SharePoint, you should have this. A field engineer wrote it because he was tired of supporting a dedicated customer in SharePoint and not knowing what was going on in the environment. So he wrote a complete performance dashboard that you can go and download and set up in your environment, and you'll know what's happening in your entire SharePoint farm. And it's free. And also updated. So as new things come out, new things that he observes in the environment or customers give feedback on, that's, again, living IP that we dynamically create and make available to you that you can go in and know exactly what's going on in your environment. This is cutting off the screen a little bit, it looks like. Sticking with well-known and proven solutions is a very frequently quoted article internally. We're all IT professionals. We have to come up with IT solutions to technical problems. But how often is it that the business is dictating to you caveats that make you unable to actually create something that makes sense? How often is the business dictating the technical solution even when it doesn't make sense? It's like being in Vietnam. Okay, well, you could go in here, but you can't bomb over here. You can't go past this border, but you still have to win. A lot of IT solutions end up being in that kind of bucket where they're stuck trying to go in and solve a solution to a problem where they know exactly how they can do it, but the business doesn't let them, either through cost, budget, time, or some politics. So what we end up finding is a lot of custom things. Does anyone here disable the Windows firewall? Probably. Do you disable it the right way? Do you trust the documentation that we wrote on how to do it properly, or did you build your own solution to take care of a security problem? We found people that actually have been exploited because they turned off things that they shouldn't have turned off in the operating system, which is why Aaron Margosis wrote this article. So some of the advice we have is, and we're trying to expose this better, a lot of the times that I've done, or some of the times I've done support cases, I've actually had people say, well, you know, I read this blog, and we implemented it, and now things are broken. Well, where was the blog? Well, you know, soandso.com. Okay, well, you go to it, it's like, this is completely wrong. And so then you have to take to the product group, and they actually write an email to the guy that wrote it and everything. But in the meantime, the customer has taken the advice of a complete stranger off the internet because they read it, and they've implemented it in the enterprise. It's scary if you think about it. We trust things that we read too much, particularly from sources that don't make any sense. The other one that we have is IT operations, the reasons you don't want to be unique in the enterprise. If you're building something that's a one-off, isn't it a bit dangerous to come up with a solution for it? If we have a build that we use through our whole enterprise and it doesn't work for a particular piece of hardware, should we still buy the hardware and have a one-off in our environment? Or if we have a build that we've certified and we find that there's a memory leak in a certain driver but we don't certify the fix, do we have the one-off for just the exchange farm? How many one-offs can you really manage in your environment and be supportable? And then what happens if the people that created that one-off or designed this custom solution leave the company? I tell a lot of stories, so I apologize. But I have a customer that they don't know how to deploy Windows without using an executable that a guy wrote 8 years ago. He's dead. He didn't write any documentation. It's about a 4.5 meg exe. I mean, it's insane. So they're so designed around this particular executable that when you go in and try and show them SCCM OSD or MDT, well, it doesn't do what this widget does. Well, it can, but you need this bull. This, you know, it's like they trusted it like a Bible, but no one knows how it works. There's a lot of cases where we find that in enterprises where your core application is written in DOS, running in a VM that doesn't have network connectivity. Everyone has a skeleton in the closet. I mean, I have customers that, you know, they pay for support agreements for Windows 2000 Server SP1 so they can still get security updates. We sell support contracts for that. Not that I would encourage you to buy one, I would encourage you to upgrade off that. But when your business becomes locked into a solution with no application lifecycle management, you get stuck in these infrastructure nightmares. I mean, I used to work at a company where we had an NT4.0 box that we were afraid to virtualize because we didn't know if it would come back up if it shut down. Had an uptime of like 2.5 years. No, don't touch that box. But a core application for financials. So what I would encourage you to do is not step down that slippery slope, not for your sake, but almost for the sake of the person that comes behind you or after you, after you've retired, although it'll give you some good stories. Yeah, those poor guys, you know, they're probably still supporting that DOS app I wrote. I mean, you know? But there's a risk in being unique. Another thing I would point you to, we do at Microsoft, in my opinion, we don't do a good job of rolling out some of the hot fixes that you really need in your environment. If you're running Hyper-V and you go to Windows updates or you run WSUS, you don't have all the updates you need to run Hyper-V properly. There's a list on TechNet that tells you, oh yeah, well, if you're running Hyper-V and you're on SP1, apply these 9 hot fixes. Well, why aren't you getting them through Windows updates? Because the other servers might not be running Hyper-V, so they don't need them. Doesn't quite make sense, does it? So Yong Ri is a friend of mine that he makes a hobby out of writing lists of hot fixes that people should go to. It's one of the most traveled blogs on TechNet, which is really a message and a testament back to Microsoft. If someone that just makes a living out of making lists of hot fixes that you might need in your environment and people are going to it at that frequency, maybe we're doing it wrong. I think. One of the things we're working on, I mean, you, enterprises, do you guys have anything that you've heard of slow boot, slow log on, where it takes like, how many cups of coffee does it take to log on to your box? Does it take 5, 10, 15 minutes? I had one that was 19 and a half. So if you have environments like that, and then you send someone on site, you pay for me to come on site, and I say, well, apply this hot fix. Bless you. Apply a hot fix. We'll shave 5 minutes off that boot time. Now you're happy, right? But aren't you also mad? Why wasn't that in WSUS? Why didn't I know about it? Well, that's a good question. So what I actually do, and I would encourage you all to do, is on your Windows update site, there's a way to RSS subscribe to the Windows updates as they come out. I would pay very close attention to those updates, because chances are you're going to need a lot of them. but they're not being pushed out to you because they're considered one-off scenarios. What some of our product groups, I think, don't understand is that our customers are full of one-off scenarios. I mean, how many of you guys run Hyper-V, SQL, Exchange? If you're running Exchange, then you need this particular Windows hotfix, not Exchange hotfix. That's where we sort of have things fall in the crack. So it's a good blog to pay attention to. We also have, this used to be a virtualization wizard, where you could go in and make sure that your product from us was supported in a virtualized environment, whether it was ours or third party. We've gotten so good at it now that it's just a list of yes, 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 no, yes, 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 no. But it used to be, if I'm running, God help you, Virtual Server 2005 SP1, which I hope none of you are. Hopefully you've moved to Hyper-V or something else by now. If you're running that, can I run Exchange 2003 32-bit with this much RAM and all this? Yes or no? But this is a good article also, just to make sure that when I call Microsoft for my SQL solution that I've built to address a business problem, can I actually get good support? Or is it going to be best effort support, and then they write me off and say make it physical? Because that's the last thing you're going to want is all my domain controllers are virtual. We have a problem we can't reproduce internally at Microsoft that you have, so we need you to make all your boxes physical and try it again. That's the wrong message for us to be delivering to our customers, frankly. But from our perspective, if we can't reproduce it, then it's got to be something in the hypervisor. Anyone heard our story that you should not virtualize all your domain controllers? Does anyone know why? It's a good story. There is no technical reason not to virtualize all your DCs. The problem that we found is when virtualization was new, we had people that didn't treat a VM the way they would treat a physical box. So they just take snapshots of your domain controllers. And then they do things like, well, you know, that patch didn't work. We're going to roll back our snapshot. And then 3 years later, when they have a problem with Active Directory replication, we go in and look, and their only surviving copy of the Active Directory database that isn't corrupt is the one that's 3.5 years old. It's a bit painful in an enterprise. We've actually had people have to rebuild their domains from scratch because their domain controllers got corrupted, and it was the rollback of, you know, going back and forth with their snapshots, losing power, jet database errors, things like that. So support looked at it and said, do we explain to every customer, here's why you don't virtualize everything, you leave one physical, or is it easier just to say leave one physical and that's our supported scenario? So let's talk a little bit about design. So when we're building something, we have to think about it in terms of capacity. How many people can we stuff in the box? And then also architecturally, how can we build it out? I mean, there's going to be some scaling things. And then also I'm going to talk a little bit about the cloud, but I'm not going to beat you up with it because I'm sure you've heard a lot about it already today or this week. Is anyone familiar with our IPDs, infrastructure planning docs? A couple people, good. If your manager comes to you, or a sales guy comes to your manager and sells them something, and then you've never heard of it and it gets dropped in your lap, the IPD is the way to familiarize with it and figure out if you can actually make it work in your enterprise. Is everyone here an expert on user state virtualization for VDI? No, not everybody? So the IPDs are friendly enough, and there's quite a few of them. So even if you think you know it all on the subject, and you may, that's fine, it doesn't hurt to get a second opinion from a doctor. That's basically what these IPDs are. The product groups have written these IPDs with the idea that you can go in and say, am I doing this correctly in a supported fashion? And there's a lot of them. Quite a few. So the user state virtualization, it's in a PowerPoint format. And you note at the bottom there's going to be notes that explain things to you and walk you through the entire scenario. talk to you about the core metrics, the core values of what you're trying to do. So if you knew nothing about user state virtualization, you could walk through this doc and have a functional understanding of it and then figure out which one of our solutions for user state virtualization would actually work in your environment for you. Because let's face it, any solution that you buy or design follows basically, what, the 80% rule? I mean, remember when we went to SANs from file servers, threw everything in the SAN, and then we got Citrix, and then we wanted to stuff everybody in Citrix, and then AppV came out, we wanted to AppV all of our apps, and et cetera, et cetera. Some things are bad candidates for our solution. With these documents, we can actually go through and figure out which ones fit and which ones don't. So if you don't know, it'll even walk you through the process of how to do your decision tree, which is pretty handy. Of course, the problem with this is time, isn't it? Does everyone have a time to, in their work week to cruise the web for a couple hours? Not Facebook, but blogs. I mean, everyone can find time for Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter, right? But how often do we get to read a technical blog? 9 times out of 10 when I go on site, I'm showing the customer something that was written 3 years ago in TechNet. That's a testament to understaffing our IT environments. If they don't have time to hone their skills, they're understaffed. So if you have a field engineer come on site and they make that comment, make sure you encourage them to write it in the report so your manager sees it. And make sure he says that you do a good job too so you can get a bonus, right? So I want to talk a little bit about architecture from a hardware perspective. It won't be long. This is something that's pretty interesting. Bruce Worthington, who used to be our storage guy for Microsoft, he wrote the thing on Windows 2000 on how to talk to storage. Bruce did a study of your atypical box. You know, it's pretty rocking. It's got 2 cores. It's running Windows 2000. Do you see these numbers, though? And I forgot to run zoom it here. Hang on a second, just in case. Like that one there. We have an advertised system bus speed of 1.6 gigabit. What's it really do is in parentheses. So if you're going to write to memory from disk, your maximum throughput's 550 megabits. But look at some of these numbers. PCI bus. So this is back when we were talking about how wide can we really scale a file server. What's the argument for the SAN? How many disks do we stuff in the box before it doesn't make any sense to put any more in? The answers are pretty interesting. And if anyone's played with Fusion IO, I did a disk study in our Premier Labs where one Fusion IO card essentially maxed out the PCI Express bus. So one card can eat all the throughput, which is impressive. But, you know, we used to buy these Adaptec Ultra 160s. Rated for 160. Oh, it can do 50 when it writes. It's a little different. It's amazing no one got sued for this. And then you look at the disks. The SCSI drives are actually pretty close to what they're advertised at, which is a testament to the Quantum Fireball or Quantum Atlas that they made. The Quantum Fireball, though, look at the IDE. Boy, as consumers, do we get shafted, don't we? So the best place to put an SSD is in your house, because chances are the hardware that you have in your house, unless you built the machine yourself, is rated like this. Oh, yeah, it'll do 133. Yeah, it's SATA 3. It'll go really fast. But even in our labs where we've gone in and analyzed, like Windows to Go. Am I supposed to talk about this? Well, I'll talk about it. What the hell? So Windows to Go. When we're looking at USB sticks that we want to certify for Windows to Go, you can take 2 USB sticks... from the same manufacturer that are rated at the same speed, and sometimes they have different metrics. Made a different factory from a different chunk of chips, what have you. The standards of quality are wanting sometimes in hardware. I'm sure that's not a surprise for some of you. But the interesting thing here, Bruce basically found in this, if we have 98.5 here, our disk can do 24, so you slap in 4 hard drives and you're done. It's not much of a file server, is it? Which is where the argument for SAN comes in. What he doesn't talk about here is how many actual transactions can the infrastructure do also, because that becomes part of the triangle problem of our disk I.O. Yeah. So with that, I'll give you another story. I'm sure a lot of you guys have remote offices and you don't like the idea of having domain controllers and file servers and, you know, virtualized boxes and things like that out in your remote offices, particularly if they're in foreign countries where things are unstable and the boxes might grow legs. That's what read-only domain controllers are really for, by the way. I've had an office that actually lost their read-only domain controller. So it was good it was read-only. But so we have an end user here. The end user is fairly happy. They have a file server in their office. So that's where they put their stuff, because that's where IT told them to. Right? Map drive, all that stuff. So even in this simple scenario, what are we dealing with from a support perspective in our infrastructure? We have to keep our SMB stack up to date. We have antivirus to contend with. Is antivirus good or bad? Sometimes some of the worst cases have ever worked are because you were running antivirus, which is awful. But if you don't run it, you could get sued, so you have to run it and then pay the penalty of running antivirus and hoping it doesn't break you. We're running a third-party firewall, maybe. We're running Big Brother software. I had one customer where they actually monitored each other. They had two security teams. So they monitored their lawyers, both teams did, and then both teams monitored each other. And then they called me to complain about boot times. It's like, yeah, you're running two auditing softwares at the same time watching each other. And in the kernel, you could see context switches out the wazoo while these apps are fighting over who gets the CPU to watch each other. It's like it's a no-brainer. But if it's a business requirement, isn't it important that the business actually understand, yeah, this is the cost of doing business in this kind of interesting fashion? But so we take our end user here. It's unacceptable they're in a remote office with a file server. So we're going to go in and we're going to do a consolidation. And where's my laptop? Well, we'll start off that way. All right, so we're going to virtualize our file servers. And there's going to be quite a few VMs. And there's our poor end user going over the WAN to a VM host with shared network. That VM's running a software iSCSI initiator. So it could talk back to storage over 10 gigabit Ethernet on the host, running 2003 32-bit Windows because they haven't certified anything yet. This happened last year, by the way. Running antivirus. They wanted to go from 17 file servers in remote offices to 4 hosted. And they said, what do you think of this idea? Does anyone think this is a good idea? So one of the few times I insulted a customer, I told them it sucked. And I'm not supposed to do that, and I apologized. And so, but I did. They needed a wake-up call. This was an awful idea. You can't take 17 file servers that are busy, consolidate them into 4, and hope the kernel memory stays up. That's number one. We're sharing our network. We have software SCSI initiators, so CPU is going to be bad. They're running a version of VMware where we couldn't judge the CPU utilization in the host. This is bad. It's an awful idea. Didn't even get into the fact that it was a shared NetApp box running NFS mounts. It's like, if this breaks, or if the user, God help them, complains about performance problems, where do you even start to troubleshoot this? But he wasn't concerned about troubleshooting this particular problem because he was the architect. It's someone else's job. Do you guys have a design team that goes in and builds a solution, looks good to them, and they chuck it over the wall to sustained engineering after it's implemented, and they never have to hear back from them again? As we get more siloed, we get teams of people that get disconnected from reality where they build something that looks awesome on paper, uses every buzzword in the magazines, and when you have to go and support the thing, it's a complete disaster. It's a very common scenario, not this, but the fact that we have these people that are building something where they don't have to worry about how do we collect a dump? How do we troubleshoot this? How would we go in and collect network traces in a non-persistent VM and see if they have slow network? An interesting anecdote to that is that one of the old hands, when I had made my offhand comment, made the comment that they had consolidated their Citrix boxes in a virtualized environment. They went from 17 to 25 because of performance problems. So when you're consolidating up, where's the win? I mean, well, Citrix won. They got more licenses for their servers. But what did we actually do? I was at another company before I joined Microsoft where we had a server consolidation project that started at 250 servers. When I left, it was at 890. I mean, where does it end? So just something to think about. Sorry if I'm preachy, but some other things I want to talk about. I have a friend that runs data centers for one of my competitors, and he had an interesting story. What happens to somebody that runs search when Michael Jackson dies? How do you plan for the activity of your primary method of making money being multiplied by 10 overnight with no warning? Isn't the cloud really the answer to that? Where you can extend out when you have to, but not have to pay for it all the time? That's where I see the cloud really being the win for an enterprise. When you become too successful, too quickly, or without warning, you can extend out and then just get rid of it afterwards. And then, does your plan work? Yeah, I'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, so, and I threw this in here kind of randomly, just if anyone cared. It's in the deck, so you can download it later. Premier service is basically how you get a hold of people like me to come in and do Chalk Talks and things like that. But most of you are probably Premier customers, so let's talk about the fire. So I had an engagement where I was brought on site to talk to some of the sharpest IT people I've ever run into about app compat for Windows 7. And I mean, the questions were level 300-400, very sharp people. I mean, they were keeping me on my toes. I was impressed. And one of the guys in the middle of the meeting, right before lunch, gets a phone call on his cell phone. He takes it. There's a pause. He says, "What are you saying?" There's another pause. He says, "What do you mean when you say the data center is on fire?" And so I'm sitting here typing away, and then I have the TAM on an IAM window, the technical account manager. So I, on the window, say, "By the way, their data center's on fire." You know, and I get back and, "Oh my God, you know, what are you going to do?" Because at that point, I can help out and maybe do triage or whatever. So the guy that's on the phone's like, "Okay, yeah, we'll take care of it." Hangs up the phone, turns to the networking guy and says, "Can you switch over to the backup data center?" Their BCP plan, their DR plan was so good, the guy gets in, does some changes in the routers, they flip some things in the SAN, and we went on with the app compat meeting. Every primary stakeholder for infrastructure was in that meeting. It was a 5-minute interruption when a data center caught on fire. Does your disaster plan work that well, or do you even know? I mean, that's a challenge, isn't it? It caught on fire 5 minutes later. I mean, the users didn't even know. They changed some routing. They were doing, SRDF or whatever application for their SANs, pumping the data across the dedicated pipe and all that stuff. They just flipped some switches, brought some boxes hot, and bang, we're done. So tell us again about how shims work. I mean, it was just the most bizarre engagement I've ever had. But a fun one. It's a good story. And I have some horror stories about monitoring in particular. We have, we write in the event log when things happen. Is anyone familiar with an ADRAP, Active Directory Risk Assessment? A few people? Yeah, it's one of the things that we sell. We come in and we tell you how healthy AD is. We did an ADRAP where we found out that one of the customer's domain controllers hadn't replicated the domain partition in 3.5 years. And it screams in the event log. I mean, you open it up and it's red everywhere. The event log. Never mind System Center Operations Manager or whatever else you're doing. And then never mind the users that aren't getting authenticated in that site because the domain controller has no idea who they are. 3.5 years. Now, but also you can take that in reverse. Isn't that a testament to the integrity of Active Directory that it can run without being replicated? I mean, we've gone on site where they have 17 DCs and only one of them works. Fortunately, it had all the FSMO roles. Another thing I would encourage you to do when you're planning out our monitoring solutions, when we're going in and looking at how do we build out something that's going to monitor our IT solution for our end users, monitor not just for uptime, but monitor for load, and then monitor for the absence of load. We had a customer that had a big CAS array, and they had an F5 load balancer that was doing all the work of load balancing for the Exchange clients. One CAS box went down in their array, and no one can get into email. Now, that's a lot of money on infrastructure to make sure things are highly available, and none of it worked. Why? No one was monitoring to see if the other 9 CAS boxes in the array were actually getting any traffic. So it's important. They were up. Don't get me wrong, but they didn't have any load, and no one knew for 9 months. So the solution, yes, it worked, but was it a solution that was sustainable and was actually appropriate? No. I mean, that one box was basically cooking. Now, you could argue that, well, they should have seen that, and yeah, they should have, but they also should have noticed that 9 other boxes were doing absolutely nothing. Also, think about the reverse. I worked at a financial institution where we wrote our own app to calculate derivatives on Itanium. So that was a little bit ago. We monitored for lack of CPU utilization. If CPU fell below 50% for more than a minute, I need to know during these hours. This is about a 9-hour period. Because if we're not grinding the CPU at 100%, we're not calculating derivatives and we're losing money. Most things out of the box would say that machine's broken and start screaming and creating help desk tickets. But in our case, we need to know if CPU is actually falling. And then the other thing is, when you're building out an IT project and you're talking about monitoring your solution and things like that, we would encourage you to do it in-house. I've seen a couple places where they've outsourced the HP OpenView, the System Center Operations Manager, and a couple consultants come in and play video games in a closet for 6 months, and then you come back, and they're done, and they leave. No one's had any knowledge transfer, and you get 8,000 emails a day from HP OpenView telling you stuff. So what do? You create a rule in Outlook that deletes them all. So you have HP OpenView monitoring your entire enterprise, but it's so noisy. The signal to noise ratio is so bad that it's easier to wait for a user to call in than to actually use the monitoring system that you paid for. That's another common scenario, unfortunately. It's worth it to learn those things internally, I think. I talked a little bit about the domain controllers that, this is one of the places you don't want to be. It's a bad place where you have a single domain controller that still has a semi-good copy of your Active Directory database, your ntds.dit, and you're in there running an ESENT util. Anyone been in that boat? This is a career-changing event. Because that error, 1507, what that says is this Active Directory database is dead. Why? Because it didn't have power backup and they lost power on it. And it was the only one that was replicating and they had no idea. Or they're probably the only one functioning because the other ones weren't replicating, rather, is the way I should have said it. Seen serious things like this. So it happens, trust me. Not where you want to be. Another thing is drivers. I used to be, until about 3 months ago, a big fan of keeping drivers up to date. Like violently up to date. I'd go to a site called modconfig and pull down the reference drivers for all my hardware and things like that. Bug check dead. Do you see what it says right there? It's manually initiated. So I was typing a Word doc and my machine blue screened with a driver that I downloaded from the manufacturer of the chipset of the box I was running. So when I went to the NT developers internally, they said, well, you had to have hit control scroll lock, and initiated this. I said, no, I was typing in Word, and I assure you, I don't use scroll lock when I type. they had left in the driver that they left publicly available for people to download basically a code path that said, oh yeah, if this happens, can you blue screen? Because we might want to know about it. It was on their website. It was a big company. I'm not supposed to name names. But yeah, this stuff can happen. Do you guys run driver verifier when you get new sets of drivers, like the client support pack and things like that? Or are we running driver verifier to make sure it doesn't blue screen our box before we roll it in production? It's a free tool. It'll sit there and pound on the driver and look for memory leaks. It'll look for bad calls in DPCs, ISRs, look for bad IO, things like that. Look for, when I ask for what version you are, will you bug check? People are familiar with MPS reports, maybe, or SDPs, where we collect information and pull it inside so we can evaluate it. I gave one to a customer once where they ran it and it blue screened their box. It's the only time it's ever happened in my 5 years at Microsoft, so I felt bad. But I went in and analyzed the dump. Turns out the Emulex driver from 2004 doesn't like it when you ask what version it is. It blue screens. All it is, hey, can I have your version? Bah. Blue screen their Exchange server. So yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry you're running a driver that's from, 6, 8 years ago, But yeah, there's a case for not keeping it too current. We don't want to be bleeding edge, but we want to have an edge, right, in our infrastructure. When I was in the CTS queues working in Exchange, I would often get asked what the root cause of a particular outage was, which is a fair question for a manager to want to know, was it his guys that screwed up, things like that. Now, I'm not going to get anybody fired and say, yeah, it was Joe, it says here in the event log. I've been asked that before and I've refused. Read your own event logs. But what if the root cause isn't pretty? What if it's our processes in IT that are causing our blue screens, our system crashes, and our outages? And then what's the cost of finding root cause? If you come to an engineer as a business and say, I haven't updated my driver since the box was released, we haven't applied any service packs, we haven't done anything, we haven't applied any firmware updates, we haven't put any microcode for the CPUs, we haven't updated our switch infrastructure, we run in the same version of the SAN prop, the software that we've been running since we bought it. Why did it break? Nothing's changed. Get that question a lot. The real question that you should be asking is, how did it work so long? Isn't it? It's a fair question too. It's not that it didn't work here. The real question is, really, it's like buying a car, never putting oil in it, and then wondering why the engine broke and getting mad at the mechanic. These things require maintenance and holistic health just like anything else. A simple exercise, go to the web and do a search for critical firmware update and then put in your favorite vendor, HP, Dell, IBM. You're going to find lots of hits. If we have updates to firmware on our systems after we buy them, we could also argue that really the OEMs aren't doing a good job of writing things or getting things out of the door. It's starting to feel like in IT, like we're playing an MMO. Anyone play online video games? How stable are those when they come out? Maybe in a year, they work pretty well. But for the first 6 to 9 months, it's a really bumpy ride. Our hardware is starting to get like that. My laptop has 41 BIOS updates, 41 BIOS versions, and I don't know if it's right yet. The controller in my SSD has 4. And one of them is to make sure that when the box boots up, it can see the hard drive. So when we have bugs that big in our hardware, it behooves us to pay attention and to basically do our due diligence against our hardware vendor, doesn't it? So again, are we being proactive in our environment, or are we going to the hospital? Are we having our crit sits? Can I do that again without the audio? Yes, good, thank you. So, but you look at it, are we ahead of the game or aren't we? And then when we get into that problem of if we're always being reactive because we're not maintaining things on the front end, then we don't have time to become good engineers, read TechNet, cruise Facebook, go to eBay, whatever. But we don't have that time to maintain our skill set and we start to stagnate in silo. I taught a class for a single engineer once. It was in the middle of a blizzard. He was the only guy that showed up. So I took him to lunch every day. Why not? And, excuse me. He works in a siloed environment. ITIL, MOF, all these processes in place. Do you know what he did the last 6 years? You guys familiar with IIS, the web server? He administered websites in IIS for 6 years straight. And he said to me, I want to quit my job. And it's like, well, you know, the unemployment at the time was good. It was a nice economy. And it's like, why don't you? It's like, who's going to hire me? I haven't installed Windows in 6 years. I know nothing about the setup process. I know nothing about troubleshooting. I know how to recycle worker pools. 6 years. If we silo too much, we're really screwing over our employees to some extent, pardon my French, but aren't we also doing our whole industry a disservice when we look at, if I want to do an IT project and I have one guy that designs it, I'm not getting any input or feedback from the other 10 people that are also skilled engineers, so their skill set suffers because they don't contribute and participate in the different areas. They don't understand the product they're being asked to support completely. I mean, it's a recipe for failure all over the enterprise. Siloing, I think, is killing us as an enterprise or as a industry. If you silo too much and become over-specialized, maybe you're a good brain surgeon, but can you diagnose the common cold? And then you run into the problem also where does everything look like a nail because we only have a hammer? I'm sure you've all dealt with security people that are like that. Maybe there are some in here, so I don't mean to talk bad about you. But at one of the organizations I worked at, everything was a security problem. He looked at the entire world as a security risk, and it was hard to get anything done. Now, there's a value in being, of being aware of risk, but sometimes you have to accept risk to do a good job, don't you? So one of the things we run into is your organizational agility. I would encourage you in your enterprise environments to have some agility to, I don't want to say do things right, but you do things logically, do things that make sense. Is this your agility? We've gone on site for crit sits where we weren't allowed to remediate the problem for a week because of change control. They were down. That's okay, we'll go to paper. You can do the change on Sunday. I mean, really. We've had plenty of problems like that where we are killed by that. Or this problem's fixed in SP1, you need to apply Service Pack 1. We didn't certify that build. We're not ready for Service Pack 1 yet. Well, it's been out for a year. Maybe you know. We're not applying Service Pack 1. You need to identify the hot fix that was in Service Pack 1 that fixes this one issue, and we can maybe do that after we get a change exception. If we're that rigid that we can't react to problems when they occur, I mean, that it's awful. Now, it's easy for me, being an outsider, because I haven't had to walk in your shoes in 5 years, it's easy for me to say, you know, geez. But do we get blinded by our processes sometimes? I think that's fair to say that occurs sometimes. And then also single points of failure. I had a customer that had us on site for 3 weeks to analyze the performance of their web application. Their web application ran an IIS, good. Has a SQL backend, good. Everything's fine. Look at all the disk metrics. Everything's cool. Looks great. In their application, they chose not to pay for a piece of software that rendered from one data format to another. So they're running the shareware version in their enterprise without paying for it. It could do 4 transactions at a time. Okay, so when you try to run 1,000 through this and it doesn't work, you call me to come in and I tell you everything's fine on my end. But really, it was a three-week ordeal. And this, well, okay, fine, we'll spend the $10,000. We'll buy it. It was like they had some personal thing against buying this piece of software. But it's common to find those single points either of failure or of bottleneck where something wasn't done appropriately, architected that way at the beginning. Maybe they designed it and said, we'll just try shareware for now and then maybe we'll buy it later. I don't know what their reasoning was. But, I mean, they ran this thing for 2 years with bad performance and had us come out and do a whole code review of their website and everything else, and it turned out to be, we're running this piece of shareware, and it queues up at 5. So you can do 4 transactions. It's interesting, to say the least. And then other stuff. Overlap of the enterprise. You guys do deployments for your operating systems. Do the client people and the server people talk to each other? Most organizations that we go to, you have 2 identical SCCM environments, one for server and one for workstation. And sometimes it's lack of trust, but sometimes it's, well, we don't talk to those guys. We don't know what they do. There are synergies in your environment you can take advantage of if you knock down some of the siloing walls. I guarantee you. Big ones. Big wastes. And then the cost of outsourcing and offshoring, really the benefits are, you know, the reduced cost and uptime, blah, 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 blah. But what about, what happens to your institutional knowledge when this happens? What do we do to our environment where the guy that wrote the application that does the deployments for our organization is let go and he didn't write any source code down? Going back to that thing I told you at the very beginning. I mean, those types of things are happening in organizations. And then the classic, what happens when this happens? So we silo. So I have a customer that they're running this piece of security software that we knew was causing blue screens on their clients. And we're on a call. I'm in London at the time, and I do a call at like god awful late in London with these guys on the west coast of the US, and they said, well, okay, it's that piece of software, you proved it to us. I said, okay, can we fix it now? No, the guy that runs that software is on vacation. Well, who's his backup? We don't have a backup. One guy, an enterprise that was over 50,000 people, ran a piece of software that was critical to the business. One guy. So what happens if he gets hit by a bus? I mean, really, what happens if he quits? If wins the lottery is a better way to say it. We don't want to get hit by a bus, right? We want to win the lottery. And I was going to harp on you about client performance, but I've probably beat that into you a little bit. But one of the things you really need to think about is we spend all of our money on this big iron in the back end. We spend money on SANs, we spend money on backup SANs, on circuits to replicate the SANs. We spend money on IPS, we spend money on security consultants and audit. How much do we spend on that? Are we spending $500 on a laptop and then the user thinks that everything you built for them sucks? I said it again, sorry. But really, when we shortchange the end user, our enterprise class application fails. When we shortchange the end user and they have their endpoint that performs poorly, what's going to happen to their experience when we move them to the cloud? Is the cloud going to succeed? Is your new IT project going to succeed? Because all they're going to hear is, oh, IT implemented a new solution. And they're going to perceive that as part of the problem, whether it is or not, because they have bad performance. I have been in environments where the users, all the way up to the CEO, refused to upgrade to Windows 7 because boot times were so bad in XP. And they said, we don't trust you to get it right in Windows 7, so we're not going to it. We don't trust you. That hurts, doesn't it? But part of it was, you cut our budget, the business cut our IT budget, so we had to cut corners somewhere, and we cut it on your devices. So now you don't trust us because you cut our budget. So there's a bit of a circle problem there, but I think one of the things that we don't do as IT professionals sometimes is give feedback because we like our jobs. But yeah, if you have slow boot, slow log on, we have a whole thing on it. If you believe in the chart, it can be very expensive. The bottom number is 100,000 users. Does everyone know this joke? No? I want to make it an interview question, but HR has flagged it, so. Any questions? Any comments? Am I too harsh? Am I telling it like it is? Am I preaching to the choir? I think I might be a little bit. Any questions? They have a microphone somewhere, but yeah, anyone? You guys good? Cool. All right. I'll give you your 10 minutes back. Thank you very much. I had a good time. Thank you.